We were talking about the hermaphroditic nature of the human being. We were pointing out that every man has passed in utero to a phase of being female. And of course he's very glad to leave that behind. But whenever we leave something behind to go towards something in front, we tend to forget what we've left behind. And therefore, the man, in going forwards towards rationality and initiative, actually, historically, tended to forget that he had any feelings, any genuine compassion for the universe, such as he observed manifest in his wife before they were married. And in this forward movement, in forgetting his other half, his physicality, and his feeling, he actually reduced himself from the level of the whole being he hoped to become to the level of half a being. Now, I want to talk particularly about this to the men, because the men are more guilty in this respect than the women. Because the women haven't really tried to go forwards at all, and so we can't blame them if they don't get there. Lao Tzu says, "He who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail." The reason for this process, if you remember, do you remember the diagram we did of the flat sea and the sloping sea floor? And the fact that in the shallow water, the cells got more sunlight and became more vigorous, self-impulsive, and eventually grew tails and became spermoid in type, whereas the eggs that were at the depths of the sea, deprived of sunlight, remained relatively passive and did not grow any tails. The ones who grew the tails began to rush about doing what they called empirical research. At least that's what they call it now. But it's the same thing. It means prodding everything you meet that looks at all weaker than you. And in the process, sexual relationships arose because the ones with the driving power of the tail attacked the ones without the tails. And in this attack, they proved their superiority. Their superiority in attack. They didn't prove their superiority in defense, but they did in attack. Now, this is tremendously important for human relationships, and specifically relationships between men and women, opposite poles. Because progressively, and particularly in an accelerated manner, over the last 2,000 years since Christianity burst on the world, the woman has been overthrown. There is a statement attributed to Christ, "I am come to destroy the works of woman." We will see shortly what that meant when we remember that at one time we lived in caves. And in those days, to be able to run for safety into the cave was the most important thing for survival. So imagine a situation in which human society is dwelling in caves and where going out into the open sunlight could be very dangerous. All kinds of large predators existed which endangered the life of man. And to run into a cave and roll a stone over the front of the cave was terribly important. But the cave was associated protopathically. Remember, protopathically means without sharp intellectual discrimination. All similar things are put together. So a cave and the womb, the vagina and so on, were all put together because they were vaguely similar. So to fly back to mummy when you hurt yourself, to fly into the cave to escape a tiger, became equivalent to go to mummy for safety, to go to earth, to hide in the dark, dank cave, away from the predators that prowl about in the sunlight, was the mode of life in those days. Then there came another concept, and it arose through men having to go out in the sunlight to hunt and to make sure that they were not killed by the predators. The men, who naturally, sexually, disliked each other, banded together. You know that they dislike each other, by looking at the behavior of stags or bull seals. There's no friendliness amongst males where the opposite sex is concerned. The whole of the animal world shows that fact. So that when men got together, they got together against their biological nature, and that is tremendously important. We could equate biological nature with the female, and a force that transcends biological nature with the male. Now imagine when the men went out in the broad sunlight, but they went in bands, so that whatever predator of whatever size they met, they could club together. Remember, that is the origin of gentlemen's clubs. They can club together any creature that singly they could not club. You then understand the ethics of gentlemen's clubs and also what to expect if you meet a gentleman. If you enter into conflict with him in daily life or in business, you will be up against not that individual, but what today is called the old boy network. That is to say, a group of other men like him, genital men. If you use your dictionary, gentleman and gentleman means the same. They will club together to maintain their individual freedom. Now, this is a dialectical thing. In order to survive individually, the men realized that they had to deny their separate individuality and make themselves into a commune. And the ground of this commune was logic, a thought that says certain things follow from certain deeds. And if you can accept that this will be invariable, that a single man fighting a large animal alone will probably lose, where 1,000 men fighting the same animal will probably win. Now that's logic. The men had to accept this logic because they couldn't survive in the fight against the predators in the daylight without accepting it. So the male came to rely on logic, on analysis of the form of the situation, and then having made the analysis, to accept that they had made the analysis, and through trial and error to find out that the analytical method gave success, and therefore to begin to like logic, in the end to love logic, and to make logic their god. That logic is the same logic referred to in the fourth gospel as the Logos. Now in the process, instead of flying into the cave for security, the men, in the situation of danger, formed squares. They put themselves back to back to face the predators or the rival attackers of other tribes. You there see the whole principle of the difference between man and woman. In the cave-dwelling matriarchal periods, safety men run back to the cave, run back to mummy, because she was in charge of the cave, and have your wounds or whatever assuaged in that cave. And that's why the pursuit of sexual intercourse by depressed men is still the method of attaining self-respect again. Every time a man feels defeated in life, whether daily life, business life, or any other kind of life, when he feels defeated, the defeat causes him to regress back to the early cave-dwelling period, so that he tends to run towards the cave. And as there aren't many caves around these days, he runs to the next equivalent, and that is the protopathically associated form, the woman, to try to get back into the original cave, the womb, if possible. When surrounded by the bulk of your mother, it doesn't matter who kicks her to pieces, as long as the kicks don't penetrate to you in the womb, that is the best place to be. And this has left a very deep psychological tendency in the male. When lowered in resistance or survival capacity by events of any kind, to want to go towards a woman, and all the other men who've not been disturbed think it's a very bad sign when a man runs home to his mother or wife for solace. But in the process of extricating themselves from the cave, the men had to formulate a new religion. Remember, religion means binding back to a principle. The original principle behind all principles is sentient power. It is power, because you can't explain cause except in terms of power, of force applied, which is also sentience, because it is only through sentience through feeling that we know anything whatever. So we have this unbreakable dual polarity, sentience and power together. They cannot be separated. You cannot be sentient about anything other than a manifestation of power, and you cannot be powerful in all departments unless you have sentience, awareness of the situation in which you wish to be powerful. So sentience and power go together. S and P, first two letters of the word spirit. Sentience and power, SP. Now the infinite sentient power is the absolute source of all phenomena that we know about. Use ASP for absolute sentient power, reduce it to a word if you like, and say the ASP. Think of the one that bit Cleopatra, it's the same one. It is a primordial energy functioning long before formal restraints in a manner called bliss. The Nirvana of the Hindus, the heaven of Christians and Muslims and so on, bliss. And bliss means uninterrupted, unimpeded motion of sentient power. Sentient power moves towards self-projected goals, and sentient power, if not impeded from them, thoroughly enjoys itself, and like God says, whatever it does, behold, it is good. It is only good because it has posited it and attained it. It wouldn't be a good at all unless it first posited it and then attained what it has posited. And when the men found they could actually survive in groups, they said, let us change the religion. The religion before men attained this group activity in the open air was called the religion of the Magna Mater, the Great Mother, the Maha Ma, a supreme female figure dwelling in the cave to whom everybody went for security and advice. But when the men realized that they could actually survive in the open air and by fighting back to back could defeat anything, then they said, we will now have a new god. So instead of the dark earth goddess, a supreme object of worship, they said, now we will worship the supreme god of the daylight sky. The name of that god was Zeus. That Greek Zeus and the Deus of the Hindus means glistening ether. When on a very bright sunny day you look up and there are no clouds, what you see is a glistening. And imagine that glistening extended to infinity, and that is the god Zeus, the glistening ether. But that same light is actually the very source, by a progressive series of condensations, of the life on Earth. There is no matter that is not degenerated spirit. There is no spirit that is not light. There is no matter that is not dark. The Earth, as a compacted mass of energy, millions and millions of years ago, was not so compacted. It was expanded, it was a gas, and it was vibrating, and it was luminous. It was a gas in a state of incandescence. It was the god Zeus. Now, the men, when they worshipped this god of light, also worshipped the god of consciousness, the god of perception, the god of wide open eyes. Those of you who've seen Indian drama, who've watched the Hindus playing their dramas of gods and demons, they will notice a very peculiar thing about them. You don't find much in Western theatre, and that is the tendency to display their eyeballs. What they're saying is, this means light. This means I am conscious. This means I know. And some of the fiercest demons have the biggest eyeballs and keep their eyelids up. They must know. Now, Schopenhauer once said that the greatest value of the human being is to attain individuality, free individual consciousness. But unfortunately, the same individuated consciousness is the biggest crime there is. That was a dialectical statement. The great supreme good of humankind is to become a free, conscious, wide-eyed, open individual. And in that very moment he commits the greatest crime. Against what? Against human solidarity as a community with rules. Now there has been a pact, an unconscious pact originally, but progressively refined by philosophy to become a conscious pact, the social contract. Whether they did it on paper first is irrelevant. The fact is that men came to realize that in the commune they could solve a problem that they could not solve individually. And yet, mysteriously, in the very moment of getting together to solve it, they destroyed the only thing they had that was worth having. The only thing that humanity has that's worth having is spontaneity, is life, immediate response to a situation without calculation. But if you respond immediately to a situation, can you have a society? And a lot of thinkers have said, no, you cannot have a society. Because if everybody is free and spontaneous, they are also unpredictable. But a society is based on a routine process. To run a society, to keep the sewers under the road instead of over them, you must have a procedure, and you must maintain that procedure. And you must get up in the morning at a certain time and go to a certain place and think certain thoughts and perform certain actions. And if you do that, then you are a socialized human being. But in the process, you have lost the reason for doing it. Because the real reason for getting together was to make life better, to make life freer, to make life more intelligent. But what we actually find in the history of social groupings is that societies have been ruled by oligarchs, that is, by a handful of men who somehow have become corrupted. Power corrupts. They have become corrupted, so that instead of remembering the ultimate goal, namely freedom, perfect intelligent cooperation interfunction, they have said, all these beings who are subject to our educational commands can be used as if they were oxen. And that's a very important idea. The oligarchs have said, all these beings who are potentially human can be kept at a subhuman level with the appropriate methods of indoctrination. And then we can be free. We can be human. But only at the expense of most human beings being animalized, reduced to the level of an intensive farm with locked up chickens and locked up pigs and cattle. We know from the last war what it was fought about, that this is true. Nazi Germany wished to eliminate anyone with any individuality. The most individual people in Germany at the time were Jews, therefore they had to go. And at the same time to reduce everybody except the top oligarchs to the level of oxen, who will not argue, who will accept absolutely the command, the dictates of the Führer. Now that is a historic repeated tendency. In the name of solidarity of effort necessary for success, proved in the ancient world by the overcoming of big predators and very weighty animals like the mammoth, the bison, in the name of that success, to say, we know how to plan better than most people, and therefore we will plan. But then they fell into planning for their own advantage and not for the advantage of the whole commune. Animal Farm was written specially to show you exactly the process. And the man who wrote it was very depressed at his own experiences in the police force and in politics and in journalism, because he saw that it was actually happening. Now, it was a male thing that brought life out of the cave, and by combining logically to become more efficient, to set up a system of social government called principle. And this principle was logic. And this principle was put up in the place of immediate spontaneous movements. Because you can't have a man who has promised, if you meet a big predator, to stay with you and to strike with you, if when he sees a saber-toothed tiger coming, he changes his mind and deserts the pact. So there have to be rules. And then some people actually think clearer than others, and because of that, those who did not think so clearly said to the clearer thinkers, tell us what to do. And some of the clearer thinkers did, and some of them did not. But those who were very near to them soon learned to kill off the very clear thinkers and to take over the authority that they had. Rather like you've seen in Iran recently, where a religious organization has displaced the authority of power and yet immediately starts doing similar things to the kind of things it's supposed to be condemning. Now this happens in every country of the world wherever men are thinking logically on insufficient data, and that is tremendously important. Now when the males took themselves out of the cave, they didn't want to have anything whatever to do with female dominance. So they decided to make for themselves special organizations. Survivors of such organizations today are bodies like the Freemasons, in which ladies are not members, but men are. And they go through mysterious rites and principles, and they commit to memory procedures of social relationship, and they are supposed to be oath-bound to obey the principles that they have given lip service to. When they dissociated themselves from the female on the outside, from the dominion of the grandmother figure, the great Ma, when they dissociated from her, they had to dissociate also from the same inside their own mind. As they dissociated from the women outside, they said, if any of the men suspect us of having feminine characteristics, they won't trust us. So we will have to eliminate the feminine characteristics in ourselves. And basically those characteristics are these two. First, a preoccupation with immediate emotional response. Because you know, at least those of you who are married know perfectly well that immediate emotional response is a property of woman. But immediate emotional response might mean that instead of going to fight the tiger, you go and have a drink by the stream instead. Because the immediate emotional response, corresponding with Kierkegaard's first aesthetic phase, is exactly the same in the woman and in the baby. The baby wants what it wants when it wants it, and so does the female side of the human being. Now, when the men realized that if they were detected to have any feminine component inside them at all, their fellow men would not trust them, they began to conceal their feminine characteristics from their companions. And then the oligarchs devise exercises which survive in military square bashing today, exercises to kill any tendency to feel, any tendency to be immediate, any tendency to break out of the logical necessity of the situation. If you go in the army, you go under oath, don't you? And you abandon your right to be a free-thinking individual. You go under orders, and that's very masculine. If you examine the history of Persian Mithraism, you will find that the whole history of military technique requires that the male warrior shall not feel. It's very difficult, if you get a baby on the end of your bayonet, to keep it on the end of the bayonet and not drop it through sensitivity, unless you train yourself hard. But when you're doing bayonet practice, what do? You are taught to pull horrible faces, to make horrible noises, and to attack. You practice on a stuffed dummy, but you're practicing to stick it in a real person. And you cannot do this if you've got any sensitivity. You can't even put your foot on a fly without cringing if you've got any sensitivity. So the great militarists of the ancient world set up a lot of rules whereby the male should divorce himself absolutely from the two feminine characteristics. One, spontaneous feeling, immediate emotive response. and two, wanting to preserve the physical body. You see, you can't be a good soldier if you protect your body in a battle, can you? You know how to play chess, toujours l'attack. If you play a defensive game, you can't win. You must go out to the enemy, and you must kill the enemy before he kills you. You mustn't sit there smoking your cigarette substitute cheroots in the trenches, wondering whether that fellow's coming over in the middle of the night. You must go out and find him. You must kill him by that most marvelous of all inventions of the military's initiative. Now this totally divorced the male from sensitivity of feeling and compassion, so that it was absolutely disgusting if you had any feeling for anybody. You can't go and kill a pregnant woman with sensitivity. It's not possible to do it. I knew a woman that was beaten when she was pregnant in Germany with a rubber truncheon on the stomach, just to show that she was an inferior being, by a man trained and conditioned to do so. Now we know that in Germany today there aren't any men who would confess a tendency to do that. But we also know that human protoplasm records all experiences in itself, and that whatever we have had ancestors performing in the past is recorded in us today and could occur again. And all this dissociation from trying to preserve your physical body and having compassion was a necessity of a militarist society that was destined to conquer the world. So there we see a man throwing out of himself the feminine components of his own being rather than admit to fellow men that he might become emotional in the middle of a battle. You don't want men breaking down emotionally and screaming hysterically and rushing away if you're under attack. And any of you who've been in the armed forces know what happens if you do run in the wrong direction, like Spike Milligan, with coward's legs carrying him away, although he himself is very brave. You can be shot by one of your own officers for doing that. And that is a very good ancient Mithraic military principle. And when the man who had decided he was going to eliminate the feminine component from his being succeeded in doing so, his success was only this, that he hid it from his conscious mind. But he had not actually thrown out of his protoplasm his own feminine component, because that is impossible. He could still feel. We know this because on the battlefield, if you shoot a man, he shouts, "Mother!" You know, the one word, mother, first word of the infant, last word of the brave. You know that one, don't you? Lovely song. Prize her while she's living. No truer friend than mother, from the cradle to the grave. And it actually happens in war that men scream for their mummies. When they get blown to bits, all the bits are shouting, "Mummy, gather me together." Like you did when I tripped when I was playing and fell on my own ball. Are you laughing at that? That was singular. Now here we see we cannot get rid of anything that we really are, essentially, substantially. But we can, under pressure from fellow men, pretend that we have got rid of it. And then what do we become? We become heroes. We become men. We become logical machines. We have no stupid sentimental compassion or such like things. We are reliable. We are not like women. We don't have whimsies. We don't menstruate. We're not unreliable. There's a whole host of horrible things that we don't do if we are men. But when they have thrown this man out in their imagination, what happens inside them? They are deprived of their own sensitivity and their own physicality. It's rather interesting that a large number of famous militaries were also queers. In throwing the woman out of themselves, they became homosexual. If you've read Lawrence of Arabia's account of how that can arise amongst military men together, you'll see a very good description of the process. When men decide they've got no woman on the inside, they feel cut off from their female component. They've got no feeling, they've got no compassion. Now, there is a thing in psychology that everyone knows about. If you don't want to admit that you've got something on the inside, you throw it out and pretend to see it in somebody else on the outside. And therefore, the males who have admitted this process of masculinization, this militarization in themselves, these same men have inside themselves, hidden in their unconscious, an ideal female. Very compassionate, very gentle, very considerate, very physical, very sensuous. Because you know when you develop your intellect, you destroy your sensuality. But then you miss your sensuality, because if you have no sensuality, you cannot enjoy the world. Not any of it, not the smell of a rose, or the flight of a bird, or the movement of a cloud. You can't enjoy anything if you're merely an intellectual machine, because enjoyment is essentially sensuous. So what do the males do? They throw out their own hidden feminine nature and they look around for it on the outside. And as soon as they see any appearance of compassion, which feels remotely like the kind of compassion that they have internally suppressed, then they say, ah, that's it. And as soon as they see sensuality outside themselves, they say, that also is it. So if they see these combined in one woman, good physique, obviously sensuously rhythmical, and with compassion, they think that's it. But what they don't know is that all they've done is project their own hidden femaleness onto an external being. Now, their own hidden femaleness, of course, being their own, is perfect. How could anything my own not be perfect? Impossible. Therefore, if I project my hidden femaleness onto some other creature, that creature has to be perfect. And if she's not perfect, she's going to be in trouble, because I shall have to make her perfect. I shall have to complain about every imperfection. And by imperfection, I mean everything that doesn't correspond with my hidden femaleness. Now, probably, I don't know that you confess it, fellows, but probably you know that this is true. That you feel outside, when you look at a woman, that you measure her for sensuality and compassion. If she's got beauty as well, physically, that's sort of a bonus. Because even very horrible women, physically shaped, I mean, if they've got compassion and sensuality, they can earn a very, very good living. Whether your nose is this way or this way, it doesn't really matter very much. But if it happens that it's correspondent with the Greek ideal as well, you count that extra. Think about this very carefully. The men started the rot. The women haven't moved. The men have gone wrong. They have divorced themselves from their own feminine components, and then they have projected them onto any woman that looks remotely like their ideal. And unfortunately, most of the ideals of men are their mothers. If your mother had big blue eyes, and moments of kindness, you go around looking for big eyes of blue and moments of kindness, and you call it your ideal. Now, unless men are prepared to stop this process of projecting their own hidden female as an ideal upon their woman partner, yes, I said men plural on their woman partner, because there's only one woman in the world, really. If they will not stop that projection, they can never attain happiness with that person. It is utterly impossible if you impose an alien ideal on another being and then require it to conform to your definition. Socrates knew that, and therefore he knew that it had nothing to do really with the woman, whether there was a successful relation or not. It had to do with the clarity of the man, recognizing exactly what had happened. And what do we find then? What have the women done when they've absolutely remained static over millions of years, whilst men have been groping towards something? What were the men looking for? They were looking for, historically, concerted action to defeat large animals and predators. They found it. In the process, they had to eliminate, for the time being during the hunt, their tendencies not to wish to be hurt, their tendencies to preserve their physical bodies against attack, and their compassion. Having done so successfully, what did they historically do with the women? Once they had come out of the cave and begun to worship the god of daylight, the women, who were hoping they would go back in the cave occasionally, used to call them, you know, saying, "Oh, Ronald, this is where you used to come, you know. When the big teddy bear came, you always ran in the cave, didn't you?" "Ah, shucks, I got lots of pals," you see. The women made a little mistake, because remember, they were not logical. They were spontaneous feeling beings, and they didn't work out step by step that the men had actually made a game by inventing a Masonic lodge to go to two or three times a week. They made the error of trying to advise men to go backwards, to regress into the cave, instead of saying, "Okay, men, go forwards, go into the sunlight, kill all the predators, make the earth fit for us women to walk in safely, and you have our blessing." They tried to bait them back into the cave. But if anyone of those men were actually baited to the point when he didn't turn up for an appointment to fight a grizzly bear, he was in disrepute, and he was called feminine, and he was disallowed in the gang. The women made the mistake of trying by means of advice and suggestions, and as this failed, they began to do what any being does. If non-rationally it tries a method that fails, they fell into tantrums. You know what tantrums are? Tantrums are releasing energy from your central nervous stores in all directions simultaneously in the body, so that every muscle you've got vibrates and contracts, and you gibber and you shake about, and you look absolutely horribly terrifying, because you're using everything you've got. Now, how did that arise logically? Because having failed calmly with a little wheedle, the woman, being non-rational, that is, not committed to the logical process that the male had adopted for his group hunting activity, being non-rational, she could not persuade herself to go seriously through all the possible steps, so she just released all the energy into her being and had a tantrum. Now, this tantrum then became a sort of mark, a supreme mark of the female nature. Women have tantrums. It was a technique, and it still survives. It does not work, because it does two opposite things at the same time. Remember what man has done. He has thrown out of himself, in his imagination, his feminine components. And those are physical sensuality and compassion. Now, when a woman is having tantrums and throwing the dinner on the new wallpaper and so on, and scowling and screaming, her sensuous desirability vanishes, and manifestly she's not in a state of compassion. So the only two things she's got have been thrown away. Now, unless we become conscious of this fact, ladies, we cannot win. The only way we can win with men is by compassion. I said we then, didn't I? The only way we can win with men is by compassion and sensuality. Isn't that nice? That's the nun and the prostitute. Now let's be very, very sure. I want a show of hands. It'll be fewer if I put it in one way round. How many men of you have got the nerve to tell me honestly that you really believe that you've got no feminine components inside you, namely compassion and delight in sensuality? Show me a hand. Hanukkah, of course, yes. She's philosophically trained, so she's using a very special significance of the word man there. She's simply not meaning a sexual entity at all. She's meaning anything that counts at all. So we'll ignore her. No other man, put his hand up. And I know, deep down inside that you know it's perfectly true. You have a hidden well of compassion and an even deeper well of sensuality in you. You've also heard me utter that word most fearsomely listened to by Greta, dialectics. Yes. Now the word compassion actually means suffering with, doesn't it? What is meant there? When a man has compassion, it's because he's become enlightened and knows perfectly well that if he does not suffer consciously with the opponent, he can't win the game. And his compassion is rational. It's a worked out compassion. I can't win with this screaming, tantrum filled creature by simply screaming back at her the logic of the situation. So what I will do, I'll put my arms around her. That's compassion. I will suffer her tantrum with her. I might even lie on the floor with her and drum my heels as well. But compassion there has a very special sense. Male compassion is the compassion inspired by logic. Whereas female compassion is the compassion of immediate aesthetics, the immediate feeling life without any rational dictatorship.
Can they both be said to have the same meaning if you use the same word?
Yes, because there's a thing called contextual criticism about terms, isn't there? The scholastics of the Middle Ages would have told you about a universe of reference. When you take a word, that word has to be in a context. And if it's not in the context, it has no meaning whatever. So we have to put it in one. And because, particularly with the human race, we have been polarized by this comic deceit into apparent males, apparent females, we have two universes of reference for every term we've got. So if you talk about the high-spiritedness of a woman and the high-spiritedness of a man, it doesn't feel the same. Say he's a very high-spirited fellow, and what kind of image do you get? And then say, she's a very high-spirited woman, and what kind of image do you get? You see, the context colours the meaning of the term. Never forget your universe of discourse, or your frame of reference, or the field in which you're trying to apply the term you're using. We know it's very difficult to remember everything all the time. The best way to do it is forget everything all the time and start afresh now and reevaluate every situation now, and then you won't have a preconception of what it's all about now, will you? Let's do that as a simple exercise now. Let us say this. Supposing we will not say what kind of beings we are. Let's throw out the term human to begin with. We're not human. We are mounds of flesh and bone and so on, sitting on things, don't bother to call them chairs, and there are processes going on inside. Now I'm going to ask you, is there a unific entity in charge of that mass of chemical compounds to flesh body? Have you all got absolute certainty that resident in that mound of flesh there is an entity, a being conducting the processes of that mound of flesh? Do you feel that that is? Who said that? You said that with your eyes closed. I saw you. I opened your eyes. Do you feel that there is an entity in charge? And I said, do you feel? Not do you rationalize?
I feel there's something holding you together.
Ah, but is it an entity? Yes, something entirely self-dependent only.
No.
No. You'd have been a very bad Buddhist if you'd have said yes, sir. Would you? What holds the waves together on the ocean? The ocean. Yeah? It's no good one little wave saying, I'm holding myself up here. It's not true. It isn't even actually a wave. Is it? It's an intellectual construct of an observer to say it's a wave. Nearly the water there is a bit higher than it is there. And then that high bit is now there instead of there, and then there instead of there. And you talk about the movement of a wave, but there isn't one. It's a construct of the intellect of man. Nevertheless, the whole ocean holds together all these waves. And in the same way, the organisms, the mounds of flesh sitting on the chairs in this room, are held together by absolute sentient power. And that means a very interesting, simple thing. Every one of these organisms is a modality of that sentient power. It is not an entity. It is not a self-dependent, separate being in its own right. It has no right. It isn't even a drop, is it? Does it? When did you have your last conversation with the drops of water? You see, you've added a human concept, drop of water. I'll ask you this, when there is what you call a drop of water, namely rain, falling through the air, is it an entity? Is it self-dependent?
No.
Self-originated? No. Is it also the same when it was up there 100 feet and down here? Or has it evaporated a bit, or gone cold a bit, or gained, or lost?
It's slightly different.
In some way it must be different. It's the same as to its absolute substantiality, the power of reality, but it is absolutely different from every moment. This is the meaning of the statement in all the major religions. The universe does not exist except as a concept in the mind of man. Yes? But there is a process. Heraclitus talked about that, and Halleck is an expert on that as well, as on what it constitutes to be a man. All flows. Panta re. There is no static entity. There is no separativity. You can't even put your foot in the same bathwater twice. Can you? Because, factually, the whole so-called universe, universe, one term, is a construct of the intellect of man. It isn't anything else. The reality is an infinite ocean of sentient power. And this power has produced this peculiar polarity that we call male-femaleness by a very simple device. You remember Hanukkah, Parmenides and his infinite sphere, an apparent contradiction. When that infinity presses onto a center, there isn't anything there other than the intent to press. There's no change whatever in that infinite field of sentient power, but the intention. It hasn't changed the essential nature of sentient power. It hasn't changed the essence of substance. All it's done is intended, like you might intend to look at your finger like that. And take your finger away and do that. When you do that, you are intending, and that intention generates in consciousness, that is in the sentient power itself, a point of reference. And that point of reference is the first male. A simple point is the first male. But the moment you get such a point of intention like that, just like your eye has inside it a particular point on the retina which gives you very, very sharp vision but is insensitive to motion. Whilst around it there is a zone of sensitivity to motion, but it's nothing sharp focus. Can you see the origin of man and woman there? Sharp focus, static, male. Yeah? Non-sharp focus, dynamic, female. Interesting. Its origin is in that power itself. We are men and women, and some lucky ones, both of them. And so to be aware that you are actually able to sharply focus somebody, like I'm looking at the end of David's nose now sharply, when I do that, his toes are relatively out to focus. But if one twitches like that, my peripheral awareness will let me know. Like a few moments ago, his lady wife, as they say, had a rotating foot like this while she was considering a certain proposition. Is that right, Jay? You see, we are actually doing two things simultaneously. We're focusing on that which catches our interest. Focus means focus, power, strike. And at the same time, we're keeping our infinite peripheral awareness in case an enemy or a lovable friend should appear over the horizon. We've always got these two things, a peripheral awareness of motion and a sharp, central, clear point of focus. Sharp, clear focus is masculine, and an aura around that sharp focus of sensitivity to motion and emotion is feminine. Now, unless we gain thorough consciousness of these simultaneously, we cannot, not ever, come to what we're looking for. We are looking for perfect interfunction. Now, to get perfect interfunction, we must see reality as it is. The man must stop projecting his ideal, female nature, onto the woman to whom he relates, and he must start examining that woman to see what she is as opposed to what he would like her to be. Now we know by the law of sentient power that when it moves, it always moves to uniqueness. That is, every person is unique and willed to be unique by the Absolute, and every person is perfect. But that person is not a separated, finite, self-dependent entity. It is a modality of the total cosmic function. And when you don't project your hidden feminine nature outside yourself onto another woman, but you generally observe and start to study that other being and compare that other being, which you think is a woman, with your own hidden femaleness, and note the differences and the similarities, and you have as much care for that external woman as you didn't have for your internal woman when you threw her out. And then you have the possibility of a real relationship, a relationship of four beings, a being male of initiative and intellection, and female, feeling, compassion, and physicality, sensuality. Four components are there. Most people in their relations don't use four components at all. They deny two of the components in their own being and then try to manipulate the external being using only two components, and therefore failing to contact the hidden two components of the other person. Because inside every woman, as inside a man, there is the opposite pole. Inside every woman, there is a hidden man. That is to say, there is inside a woman a logic that she won't use and an initiative that she won't use. Why not? You know, in Buddhism, there is a theory called the doctrine of the Bodhisattva. Now, a Bodhisattva is a being who refuses salvation for himself until everyone else has been saved. Now this also, just like the origination of male-femaleness in the original sentient power, so there is this Bodhisattva. That is to say, that as there is only universal power making the universe, and there is infinite power beyond the universe pressing in to the universe to pluralize it, to animate it, dynamize it, make it unique in all its expressions. In that bodhisattva, we have nothing but the expression of the absolute intent and knowledge that there isn't anything other than itself. If anything's going to be saved, it must be that the infinite saves itself, because we are only modalities of the infinite. And if it doesn't save us, it hasn't saved itself, because we are modalities. If that sea doesn't calm its waves, then the sea is not calm, is it? So if we are not educated as human beings to become aware of the realities of ultimate sentient power and what it can do, if we are not educated to become aware of that and to cooperate with it, we make a mess. We make a mess in this very, very cosmos which is precipitated by that power. So we make God, which is the short name of that absolute sentient power, we make God unhappy by mucking about. And it's that that required the incarnation. Into the human being, that spirit, that consciousness, that intelligence, must descend and must educate the human race to stop it mucking about. Because until it can actually behave in that fourfold manner, which is the true reflection of the absolute's four aspects, until it can do that, then universal unrest is unavoidable. What we call collective social anxiety is a minute portion of cosmic anxiety. And what we call cosmic anxiety is just the biggest sphere of infinite anxiety. And that anxiety is determined to come down in every one of us and educate us whether we like it or not, because if we are not educated properly in that cosmic principle, we annoy God. Now, some people would think that was a heresy. How can we annoy God? And the answer is simple. We can and we do, because that same absolute is all there is, and its essential qualities are sentience and power. That means to say that wherever it is, in every one of its modalities, it is able to initiate changes, it is able to build, it is able to destroy, so that we actually have the power to disturb the universe. Not only do we have Americans going and defecating and urinating on the moon, but they'll do this throughout infinite space in the future unless they are properly educated. It won't be a question of just reclaiming Thames sewage water to make it relatively fit to drink, providing you've not drunk decent water in the Lake District. It means that if you wanted to go for your holiday to one of the attendant moons of Saturn, when you got there, you found somebody left a blooming potato crisp bag there and spoiled the scenery. Now, until we educate people to take their rubbish away with them when they've gone on a picnic, the universe is not really fit to live in. And therefore, that universal power aims to educate the human race. And for the human race, at this moment of evolution, it requires today that men shall confess that there's as much woman as there are men. And that women, who've always known that there's as much man as there are woman, shall start using their initiative and their intelligence instead of tantrums. If we get hold of this clearly, we'll find it's a very, very simple cosmos we live in. But remember, simple does not mean easy because of inertia. What is inertia? It is the amount of energy put into a behavior pattern over all the time past. And we have been millions of years evolving, and we've made millions and millions of ancestral errors, and those errors are all engraved in our protoplasm as emotive tendencies, fears, hopes. They're all there. And they make it difficult for us to live the simple life that we could live. In a simple life, you can actually afford to tell the truth to anybody. But could you afford to tell the truth to everybody in business? Could you afford to tell which group of shares you intended to buy to all your pals without them jumping and buying them a bit early? Don't you actually find yourself being a little careful about letting out what you call useful information? You're saying it's the way you have been brought up in a competitive society, you've been trained to tell lies and to varnish them. We know that everybody does it. It's a bit of hard logic. Any capacity that we've got, whatever, is a derivative of that universal power, isn't it? We can't evolve other than that which the power allows us to evolve. Only that which it is potentially can we become actually. But we are intelligent, are we not? So it must be fundamentally intelligent. And as we are the only modality, it must know our purposes. And it has a peculiar power, in the Bible it's called the curse. A peculiar power that when two beings are in a certain kind of relation, it can actually bring them closer together by simply removing energy from between them. And that creates what's called a line of least resistance. And they then move together and believe that they are following their own inclination. But they've actually been manipulated by the field for their education. How do you like that? Interesting. Now the male mind says... The field has the whip hand, absolutely. If anybody has any other purpose than the field has, the field, being eternal and infinite, can afford to let them have it in both senses of the word. It can let them fulfill their purpose. And they say, oh, by the way, logically implied in that was this. It doesn't need to beat anybody up. It does what Jesus says. It goes in the way, and it goes 2 miles for one. You want to do something, it'll let you. It'll make a slight incline for you to run down, so you do it rather more thoroughly than you intended. Because its sole purpose is the creation of a dialectical being of two opposites, namely sharp, focused, so-called masculine, intelligence, wide-eyed, alert, and infinite feeling awareness. And both of these reflexively. Intellective reflection and emotional reflection. And these to be so interwoven that you cannot separate them out. I know that sometimes, Bill, when you are writing and when you're talking to me, you say, I mean big S, not little S. Yes? And when you said self then, were you thinking clearly about whether you meant little S or big S? Well, reformulate your question now and tell me which S you're going to use. Big S is infinite sentient power itself. Little S is sentience identified with the finite ego structure. Not the little one. Well, in that case, you cannot differentiate between yourself and the other person. Not unless you were identified with the ego. What you tend to do, the word individual means in a state of individuation and therefore necessarily identify with formal structures. And therefore, if you identify with the egotism, you can't be an individual and identify with your individuality to the exclusion of another individual without being little s ego identified. You know, the dupe in the marriage commitment is that you had a woman inside you, suppressed, and that you saw somebody walking down the road and thought, oh, good God, there she goes. And instead of saying, there I go, as I imagine myself. You see? The dupe is that the field says, oh, here's another bloke that needs educating. In your case, here's a Roman that wants his empire knocking to pieces. So show him a Viking. Isn't it? Very clever. And if you identify with capital S, you must know that that Viking and that Roman are in no sense different. They're logical presuppositions. Builders of empires, tearers down of empires. They're identical. That's why Heraclitus is called the obscure, the Scottish thinker. Well, they're not different. Are they not all sentient power?
Yeah.
When you go for a walk and you lift one leg off the floor to stand on the other one, yeah, and then you put that one down and lift the other one up, is there any difference between standing on that leg and standing on this leg in order to walk? What's the difference? Is it? Do you know why? Because your brain is parted down the middle, right? And one hemisphere is concerned with rationality and self-defense, and the other is free. Yeah? So it's only because you have been conditioned on the left side to small s that there is a difference. That's an intellectual difference. It's a fabrication. It isn't a real difference. It's not an essential difference. It's a fabricated pseudo difference.
Well, then, really, when you
oh, fine, I like that, yes. Absolutely. That's the meaning of there is no God but God. You can't have a God other than God. You can't have a sentient power that isn't sentient power. And that's absolutely the only real.
What about the difference
between
transcendence and incarnation?
We had this a bit earlier today, actually. When you say reincarnation, technically you mean to go again into a flesh. The body. Yes, but you see, the calm means your body of flesh. Just translate that, will you? Say your sentence again and ask what the difference is between being in the fleshly body and the other. No, with transcendence you are not identified with the fleshly body you are using. But you have one. Yes. And the essential of it is this. The fleshly body is a modality of the sentient power which is transcendent. There's no difference between transcendence and fleshly body. That's why a good Zen exponent, when he's asked by a student of 50 years study, who says, please tell me what ultimate reality is, and he says, that banana. Well, that's why Heraclitus said, you do and do not put your foot in the same river. Because the differences are intellectual fabrications, where the intellect has abstracted itself from its wholeness in order to do this clever logical trick of ganging up to defeat the predators. And it's essential when you say self that you remind yourself which self at any given second you're talking about. The finitely identified social ego structure or the absolute infinite sentient power. There is no difference of race, colour or creed in the absolute.
We have though in the past differentiated between the ego self between that part of oneself identified with one's name as opposed to the individual.
Yes, but that you see, identification is the key. You're given a name as a baby in order to be a convenience to your parents and to society at large. And the things they say to you, they say by repeating that name over and over and over again. So a certain group of socially conditioned ideas become connected with that name. And that's your lowest social ego structure. But your individuality is bigger than that. Say in the psychology of Carl Jung, he would say that your individuality, the psyche, is actually much larger than your ego.
Still not with the big
S. Still not with the S, no. Because there is no individuality as self-dependent, self-originated. Everything is infinite and absolute. Do you mean the identified or the individuated self? The individuated self is that closed relative group of experience elements recorded in the biofield, the energy of your body, which is itself the binding sphere in which your little social ego centered on your name is built. If the baby hadn't got an individuality in the first place, it wouldn't respond when you called it a name. That's very good Chinese philosophy. In China you have three fundamental elements: heaven, earth and man. And man is the mediator between heaven and earth. Heaven is yang, intelligence, light, purposeful, initiative, male. Yin is not intelligent, because intelligent, the telos, means purposefully directed to a goal. She's not. She's wide open. So she's not intelligent. And she is dark. And she's mysterious. And she's not separated out from the collective unconscious of the whole universe.
Same thing as only one woman.
Same thing as only one woman. But you see, this polarization occurs by absolute sanction of that absolute sentient power, which is willing the man and the woman. And mysteriously, the woman is a sacrificial figure whereby the man becomes himself reflexive. Aren't they not weak and strong men? What do you mean? Do you mean physically? Yeah, I know some women that can beat a man to pieces. Do you mean... Do you mean strong sensuality? No. There are some women that through social conditioning are more inhibited than others. But a good fiddler can get the same tune off any old fiddle, even the cheapest plywood. It's only social imposition that creates these apparent differences. You'd be surprised what luscious opportunities walk about that men don't know are like that. I knew one very wise old psychiatrist who said, "I make it a rule when I'm given a spinster aged 70 not to alert her to the possibilities because it's a bit late." Yeah. What he meant to say was in the day, because he was busy. And he had a very compassionate heart, that man. Because he once threw a coin to a welfare worker who wasn't pretty. In the spirit of Socrates. Would you like to retire and consider your verdict?